Okay. Modes of reading is a first-year module. It is taught on a weekly basis, one lecture, one seminar. I'm going to show you where to get information, which is from the module website. And the only reason I'm showing you the module website is because I want to show you where to have access to the assessment, where to have access to the lecture notes, so that you know where to get them for next week's lecture. On this web page, you'll see a list of all the lectures. I'm sure you've seen it already. Can you see where it says lecture podcast? This will be hyperlinked today, and the hyperlink will take you to the PowerPoint presentation. And below my name will be a little icon for the podcast. You just click on it, and you can hear the podcast. Usually, they're up within a couple of hours after the lecture. So if you're ill and you're unable to come to the lecture, make sure you listen to the lecture before you come to your seminar on the same week. The other important webpage is the assessment webpage. On this webpage, you will have details of all the assessment we want you to do on this module. We have two formative pieces of assessment. Formative means they're unassessed, but they're required nonetheless. You will not be able to pass this module unless you've submitted the unassessed pieces of work. So the urgent thing for you to note is that the first piece of unassessed essay is due in week 5. We're now in week 1. The first piece of unassessed essay is due here, the 5th week of term. And we will post details on this webpage. See where it says here, recent papers? We will change this soon, and it will say titles for the first unassessed essay. We'll post a Word document and a PDF file. This is where you access information for the first piece of unassessed essay. And I'll talk about it some more next week or the week after. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about the website. So we go back. I hope you have by now purchased all the texts for this module. You know there's a book sale on Friday, so if you're still missing some books, you can go to the department in room 8545 on Friday and buy all the books that you're still missing. They're second-hand books. Second-year students are selling them. Another thing I wanted to say about the website, and I forgot, is that for every week, you will notice that we teach this module in units. Every unit has a primary text and then a series of theoretical essays attached to that primary text. So the point of the lectures is to show you how to read a particular text using different theories. Does that make sense? So it's the same primary text. So you've got Magic Toy Shop. Today I'm only talking about ways of reading. Next week I'll give a full lecture on Magic Toy Shop only, without any theory. In week 3, I will talk about Virginia Woolf and Simone de Beauvoir. You will need to have read, Lodge is the editor of your thick theory text. That's why it says Lodge 5. And that's essay number 5, not page 5. So in week 3, you need to have read the essay by Virginia Woolf in the anthology and the essay by Simone de Beauvoir. And during the seminar, you'll discuss the theory in relation to Magic Toy Shop. And that's what my lecture will do as well. So basically, you're getting from me a full lecture on Magic Toy Shop, but then also 3 lectures giving you 3 different interpretations of the novel. That's why this is called ways of reading, modes of reading. Do you understand why we're reading the theory? So this is how I want you to read the theory, because as we progress on this module, the theory becomes more abstract and more complicated. That's okay, because what you want to get out of it is, how do I apply this to a primary text? I don't want you to memorize the theories. We don't want to become disciples of any theorist. We don't want to parrot the theorists or quote from them, you know, by heart. We don't care about that. We want to read the theorists, then close the book and ask questions like the ones I'm going to give you in a minute and say, what do I do with this? How can I use this theory to generate my own reading of the primary text? Yeah? Are you excited? I hope so. Okay, otherwise it'll be 10 weeks of hell for you. Okay, so then you go away for reading week, you know, have something nice to eat and sleep, and hopefully you'll be reading Ginsberg's Howl, and then Emma will come and do exactly the same thing. She will ask you to read some theories, and she'll lecture on the theorist in relation to the poem. Okay. Right. So what do we want you to do on this module? We want you to read a primary text, then we want you to read a lot of theory, and then we want you to ask questions. That's the whole point of this module. Through questions, you generate ways of reading. And that's what I'm going to demonstrate today, is how we want you to read these texts. So some of the questions that we want you to ask are, for example, when you first pick up a text, what cultural problem is being set up? Whether you're reading a primary text or a secondary source theory, you pick it up and you ask, what is the cultural problem that is being set up here? Secondly, these are sample questions. They're a good starting point for you. Why might readers at a particular time and place find this work compelling? Another sample question is, are there differences between my values and the values implicit in the text? So the first three questions I've shown you here are about the cultural problem that the text is inviting you to consider, the readership, so thinking about who might have read it, who might it have been written for, and also who are you as a reader, and are there differences between the values implicit in the text and your own values? Okay. What kind of cultural intervention is this text making? If it is posing a cultural problem, then what kind of intervention is it making into that problem? And then, how is it positioning me as a reader? How is it speaking to me? Is it inviting me to take action? Is it inviting me to consider my own values? How am I positioned here as a reader? And I think the most important question is the following one. What is the text setting up as normative? What is the norm in the world of this novel, in the world of this poem? What would be seen as normal? And what is being set up against the normative as different? As abnormal? As anti the norm? And I want to say just a little bit more about this question. For example, this question can be translated as, how is the text setting up the category of woman or female? What is a norm in this text for feminine behavior? What does a woman look like in the norm of this text? Is it in opposition to man, male? Or is it in opposition to other women who are seen as anti the norm? Is the normative notion of woman of any particular class, race, ethnic group, or sexuality? Do you see how we break it down? What is the norm? And then, of course, you ask the same question if you say, how is the text constructing man? What mode of masculinity is being promoted here? And what is seen as unusual, abnormal, anti-conventional, non-conventional masculinity? But beyond gender, this question could also be translated to say, is there any particular social unit that is being privileged by this text? Is there any geographical, historical, or ideological location that is being privileged? Does this text understand a particular center to the world? And if so, where is the center? Is it London? Is it a particular city? Is it the provinces? Is it the academy? Is it the home, the family? What is the norm in terms of location? These are some sample questions that I want you to get started asking when you read Magic Toy Shop for next week. What you will notice from these questions is that I'm inviting you to think about the text, its relationship to the world around it, and about your relationship to it. At no point did I tell you, and I am kind of telling at the moment, I am not in any way telling you to ask questions such as, what was the intention of the author who wrote it? Who was the author? At no point did I say, go and research the biography of the author. Go and read interviews with the author. Go and find out what the author intended. We're not doing this at this stage in the module. And the reason we're not doing this is because for this lecture, I would like you to practice a particular kind of criticism. And this particular kind of criticism is called new criticism. It's close reading, basically, what we're doing. It's close reading. And I want to say a little bit more about that. This way of reading without considering the author's intentions, without worrying about what the author meant to say, was advocated a little while ago by American critics who called themselves new critics. And they called the type of criticism they practice, which advocates not thinking about the author, avoiding thinking about the author, new criticism. New criticism was developed in the 1920s and became popular in the US in the 1940s. So it's a little bit old for us now. So what we're getting out of new criticism is just their ability to do close reading. That's all we're interested in right now. The new critics advocated close reading and detailed analysis of poetry. And they called themselves, They called themselves ontological critics. It's a word that scares people outside the English department. So if you practice using that word in various sentences, you can always win an argument. You can always say, it's actually an ontological question. And then you've won the argument. So they call themselves ontological critics. They were not interested in the personality or the mind of the poet. They were not necessarily interested in the political and social implications of the text. They just wanted to focus on the application of semantics. And it is thanks to them, thanks to the new critics, especially these two people, Wimsatt and Beardsley, that we now understand the dangers of looking or paying too much attention to the intention of the author. They coined the term the intentional fallacy. They wrote an essay entitled The Intentional Fallacy in 1946. And in that essay, they argued that the intention of the author is neither needed nor necessary for our understanding of the text. We don't need it, and it's not necessary for understanding the text. And this essay became central to the development of modern literary theory. In 1964, the French critic Roland Barthes coined the term la nouvelle critique, which is new criticism, denoting a new approach to interpreting texts. What he explored in this essay is the work of interpretation. How might we approach a literary work without immediate reference to the author's biography or historical text? He asked, is it possible to establish an interpretive method that is attentive to the work itself and its internal structures, its linguistic patterns? And more importantly, he asked, how can we assess the relation of fictional characters or situations to a sense of reality? That's really important. He's asking, how can we establish a relationship between fictional characters, fictional situations, and translate them so that we can have a sense of reality from this fiction? Yeah? Okay. And these are all questions that we are going to encourage you to engage with in the seminars. So what I want to do, I realize I've just hit you with a lot of theory. What I want to do is try and illustrate how we use these questions and just to show you the kind of exercise we want you to engage with. Here's the start of a story. Once upon a time, there was a village girl, the prettiest you can imagine. Her mother adored her. Her grandmother adored her even more and made a little red hood for her. The hood suited the child so much that everywhere she went, she was known by the name... Oh, you all had good childhoods. Yes, that's right. She was known as Little Red Riding Hood. This is the original story of Little Red Riding Hood, which was originally, as you know, written by Perrault in 1697. You're probably, of course, familiar with what happens next, but I just want to give you bullet points of how Perrault wrote this story. So what happens is her grandmother is ill, mum gives her a basket of food, sends her off into the forest and says, you know what, stay on this path and don't talk to strangers. Go to grandma, be a good girl. So she does speak to the wolf in the original story. In spite of her mother's warning, the wolf tells her to take a shortcut, which of course is not a shortcut. He gets to grandmother's house first. He eats grandmother. She arrives to grandmother's house, ups in the bed with the wolf, and there's the famous dialogue. Ah. Grandmother, oh no, I'm being recorded. I usually do voices, but I won't do voices. Grandmother, what big arms you have, the better to hug you with, my child. Grandmother, what big legs you have, the better to run with, my child. Grandmother, what big teeth you have, the better to eat you with. And upon saying these words, the wicked wolf threw himself on Little Red Riding Hood and gobbled her up. And then the Perrault version is followed by a moral. And this is the moral. From this story, one learns that children, especially young girls, pretty, well-bred, and genteel, are wrong to listen to just anyone. And it's not at all strange if a wolf ends up eating them. I say a wolf, but not all wolves are exactly the same. Some are perfectly charming, not loud, brutal, or angry, but tame, pleasant, and gentle, following young ladies right into their homes, into their chambers. But watch out if you haven't learned that tame wolves are the most dangerous of all. Now, the story of Little Red Riding Hood inspired a whole range of writers to respond to it. And some authors wrote other versions. Some authors picked up on particular aspects of this fairy tale. I'm not sure it's fairy, but this horrific tale. And picked up on one aspect and wrote their own version of it. So I'm going to show you just one example of a revision of Little Red Riding Hood, and that's the one which you, I'm sure, quite familiar with, is the one by the Brothers Grimm from 1857. So the Brothers Grimm published their version of Little Red Riding Hood, obviously in German. I can't speak German, but that word means Little Red Riding Hood. In this version, because if I say it, you'll laugh even more, so I prefer not to say it. In this version, the mother clearly warns, there's a whole paragraph in this version of the mother clearly warning Little Red Riding Hood not to stray from the path and clearly indicating that she must not speak to strangers. And it is advice that the little girl ignores. But in this story, the wolf gobbles up grandmother and Little Red Riding Hood, but then a huntsman happens to find the wolf in grandmother's house, and the huntsman uses a pair of scissors to cut the wolf's stomach and rescue grandmother and Little Red Riding Hood, who are just scared in the tummy hiding. Okay, so he rescues them, and we are told that they all lived happily ever after. Okay, so what do I do with these different versions of the story? I ask myself the first question, which is, no, I don't expect you to know it now. But next week, you should know it. First question is, what cultural problem is being set up? Okay, well, when I see a moral clearly appended to the end of the story, I can easily decode the cultural problem that I'm supposed to be thinking about. So in the Perrault story, the moral told me that this is a story about good and evil, about the loss of innocence, about the frailty of young girls, the threat on them by preying men. with the Grimm's version, I ask, what cultural problem is being set up? And here I find there are a few issues that come to mind. Namely, the daughter's open defiance and rebellion against her mother's instructions. And of course, the very problematic ending where the huntsman acts as the rescuer of both grandmother and Little Red Riding Hood. I must notice then that the defiance of the young girl is written into the text. It's much more elaborate than the Perrault version, so that it has consequences. That defiance has consequences not only on the girl, but also on other females. Women suffer if they do not obey the norms prescribed to them by society. The mother survives. In both versions, the mother is safe because she does her duty. She acts as a handmaid of the prevalent culture. She does her job, she warns her daughter, and she teaches her how to be a good girl, so she's safe. The huntsman is the rescuer. His role is to restore order. He removes the threat. He rescues the girl, and the traditional patriarchal setup is restored. They're a happy family. And then, of course, I'm not going to ask all the questions, but this is what I do. I carry on asking the questions until I come up with a close reading of the text which unravels its meaning and allows me to decode the significance. I want to pick up on contradictions. I want to spot gaps, things that are being left unsaid, and ask questions about why are there gaps in this text. And although I might be able to establish what this text means to me, and I may be able to argue that this meaning might change with time, depending on who interprets the story, one thing that remains unchanged is the language of the text. So I've just shown you how to ask critical questions to do close reading, and I've explained to you that the new critics told us don't ask who the author was. Now I'm going to move on and show you how to read this text by paying attention only to the language. This is why I've got De Saussure on here. So at this point in the lecture, I want to move our thinking deeper into the text. This is still part of the close reading. And think about the theories advanced by De Saussure, a little bit of Freud and Lacan. Can I just say, I do not expect you to read these essays, which are in Lodge. That's why I'm talking about them. They are in your anthology. I don't expect you to learn them and know them, but I am mentioning them because I want you to get a feel for how we use theory. Does that make sense? Good. So I want to consider these theorists because their ideas shed light on the importance of personal interpretation and because they have each developed approaches to reading which, when we practice them, when practiced, reveal meanings that other readings fail to do. So starting with De Saussure, the only thing I want you to remember from De Saussure is this. De Saussure distinguishes between language and speech. He argues that language is social and speech is individual. Language is essential and speech is ancillary, more or less accidental. Speech is more or less accidental. Language is not a function of the speaker. It is the product that is passively registered by the individual. We acquire language. You must have heard this term. We acquire language as we grow up. It gets registered onto us. Speech is an individual act of the will. When we speak, we make decisions as to how we use language. It is the combination through which the speaker uses the codes that are provided by language in order to express her own thoughts. Is this making sense? It's quite simple. I'll show you how this becomes significant. So language is a social institution. It's a system of signs expressing ideas. And therefore, it is comparable to writing because it's a system of thoughts that expresses ideas. All of us in this room have acquired language, but we don't all use the same speech. In the same way, we may all know the story of Little Red Riding Hood, but we won't all write it in the same way. I've just shown you one example of how the Brothers Grimm rewrote Little Red Riding Hood. But I want to show you another more recent version of Little Red Riding Hood, which really illustrates how language is assumed to be shared by all of us. And it is speech that brings about our personality. Look at this weird version of Little Red Riding Hood by James Thurber. This is from 1940. One afternoon, a big wolf waited in a dark forest for a little girl to come along carrying a basket of food to her grandmother. Finally, a little girl did come along, and she was carrying a basket of food. "Are you carrying that basket to your grandmother?" asked the wolf. The little girl said, "Yes, she was." So the wolf asked her where her grandmother lived, and the little girl told him, and he disappeared into the wood. You see how abbreviated this is? Gets better. When the little girl opened the door of her grandmother's house, she saw that there was somebody in bed with a nightcap and nightgown on. She had approached no nearer than 25 feet from the bed when she saw that it was not her grandmother, but the wolf. For even in a nightcap, a wolf does not look any more like your grandmother than the Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer looks like Calvin Coolidge. Hello? So, the little girl took an automatic out of her basket and shot the wolf dead. But wait, there is a moral, just in case you didn't get it. It's not so easy to fool little girls nowadays as it used to be. Isn't that an excellent example of what I'm trying to explain? You get it, language and speech. This version relies on all the linguistic signs already established in the context of the story. Thurber uses speech to write in codes provided by language. Language is like a fund, de Saussure says. It's a fund accumulated by the members of the community through the practice of speech. Language, he says, relies on the collective in the same way as these stories rely on our collective recognition of the codes inscribed in them. Does that make sense? Okay, so at this point, that's all I want you to know from de Saussure is the distinction between language and speech and how that is useful to interpreting literary texts. So now I want to move on and do one aspect of Freudian theory, because life is too short to know Freud. And the one thing I want to talk about Freud is his distinction between manifest and latent meaning. Okay, here we go. Freud, as you very well know, I'm sure, worked on dream interpretation. And he argued that our unconscious dictated our dreams. He argued that every dream contained manifest, meaning obvious, elements, as well as latent, secret, repressed, hidden elements. And his case studies are useful in showing us the importance of asking this question. What aspects of this text have been repressed, alluded to, and or made inaccessible? And why? Why are there aspects of this text that remain unsaid, undeveloped? The manifest content of a text is accessible to all readers, but its latent content is revealed only through interpretation, and that's what we want to get at. I don't want you to write close reading of texts that say, look, there's short sentences, and oh, look, it's written in the present tense. No. The obvious signs, we can read them, everybody here can read them. The whole point of this module is to find ways of reading that reveal the latent content. So by learning to read manifest signs through close reading and ask questions like the ones I showed you before, we can access some of the latent content of a text. But I really have to pause and sort of remind you here that I'm not saying we're going to psychoanalyze characters in the text. Yeah, you know that, right? We're not going to say what was going on in her mind, Little Red Riding Hood, you know, was she feeling, was she remembering a past trauma when she changed? No, that's not what we're doing. We're reading signs of the text. And I'm going to show you how Angela Carter kind of, am I going to show you Angela Carter? Yeah, I will. Angela Carter kind of really explodes that and sort of makes her into this really sexy girl who wants to lose the bet against the wolf. I'm sure you've read it, and be kissed by the wolf. So Carter really delves into what was going on in her mind and what did that dirty girl really want, sort of thing. We're not doing that. So De Saussure stressed the importance of understanding language, and Freud the importance of understanding the unconscious. Well, Lacan came along in the 1960s and challenged both of these theories. And his reading is meaningful to us because it allows us to adopt a way of reading that sees the unconscious structured like language. And what he means by this is that if the source of our understanding of language is through socialization, if we understand language by being part of a society because we acquire it when we are part of society, then there is no getting outside language. If we're acquiring language by being members of a society, this means that our unconscious is structured like language. But if language is unconscious and speech is conscious, and if language allows us to understand the meaning of things, then it follows that meanings are not stable. This is what he says: meanings change and are sustained only by reference to other meanings. So that the meaning we give to our ideas about justice, about love, about fairness, about beauty, is forever changing because the signified that's attached to them changes. I'm going to illustrate this. It's a really crucial concept because you're just starting off on this module and you haven't started doing textual analysis yet. What I want to encourage you to do is challenge your understanding of concepts and try to think of how the word can signify a variety of meanings. It's a very difficult exercise to start with, but that's the whole point of this closed textual analysis. I'll illustrate what Lacan means. Lacan says, if I say to you tree, this is his exact example, if I say to you tree, you and I imagine something with standing in a field with green leaves on it, right? And then you say, oh, yes, tree. If I say, go and meet me under the tree, hopefully we all go to the same object because we all have the same idea of a tree. However, so this is where the word and the symbol combine and we all agree on what tree means. We all go towards the tree. However, he gives an example of a brother and sister sitting on a train facing each other. And the train arrives at a train station and there are two doors to the loos. One says ladies, one says gentlemen. And the girl says, oh, we're at the ladies. Obviously, he's translating from French, that's why it sounds weird. Nobody would say that, but fine. We're at the ladies. And the boy says, no, we're at the gentlemen. And what Lacan says is they're both looking at the same thing, a Lou door. But depending on where they're sitting, and where what they're looking at, the meaning of their words shifts. So the object that they're alluding to is still called the Lou door. But that meaning has shifted depending on what you're looking at and what your idea of the Lou door is. The boy looks at it and says, we're at the gentleman. And she says, no, we're at the ladies. So what he's alerting us to is for us to be aware that the signified, what is being talked about, the signified changes. And we must not assume that the words that are on the page mean what we think they mean. Does that make sense? Handsome man. I don't think anybody here would agree on what a handsome man is, because what it symbolizes in our head shifts. It's a very simple example, but you can see how we can apply it to literature. Does that make sense? That's what we want to get out of Lacan. We want to get out of him is that when we're reading, picking out keywords, words like magic, words like love, words like deceit or justice, we want to constantly think that the meaning of this word shifts with the speaker. It shifts with the time. It shifts with the genre of writing. Yes? Oh, have you lost the will to live? Are you okay? I think this is the end of my theory. So what he's saying is, when I say to you, little Red Riding Hood, I want you to resist seeing that. And what that is the cover of the Perrault story. The traditional image that we have of Little Red Riding Hood, a white girl, looking quite polite, dressed in 17th century clothes, wearing the red cloak that grandma made her. Look at the wolf. He looks so obviously bad, you know. He looks lusty, tempting the girl. This is kind of the image that we grew up with when we say Little Red Riding Hood and the wolf. And Lacan would encourage you to rethink the signified of that word and possibly think of Angela Carter's version of Little Red Riding Hood. This is the cover of The Bloody Chamber, Carter's collection of stories. And can you see what Little Red Riding Hood's doing? It's not very little. And I'm not going to comment on the riding, but she's got long blonde hair. And there's no red cloak. It's long gone, left it behind in the... And they're out in the field having a good time. So basically, the meaning, the significance of the story has shifted. Because, you know, on a superficial level, times have changed. But also because what we get out of it has changed. Where we locate threat has changed. And in many ways, I mean, if the wolf was my son, I'd be like, she's the wolf. This is a, you know, dangerous girl. Get her off my son. So the whole concept of the idea of Little Red Riding Hood and the wolf has shifted. And that's what Lacan really wants you to think about. How what you're reading really relates to you and how you're decoding meaning in a text. Yes? Great. So to sum up, these are key terms that I used today. And there are what I've got here is Cudden. Cudden is the editor of the Dictionary of Literary Terms, which I think was shrink-wrapped with your theory text. Is that right? If you bought it from the bookshop. And this is the page number in the Dictionary of Literary Terms where you can find short essays on the key terms and on the authors. So what have I done today? I started off by encouraging you, I really would like to force you to stop talking about intentions of the authors. Intentional fallacy is to be avoided. I gave you samples of critical questions that I want you to think about when you read Magic Toy Shop or reread it for next week. And then what I tried to do is show you how we apply these questions to a typical story that we're all familiar with. Last thing to say is, for next week, I want you to read Angela Carter with the questions, and please make sure you have purchased all your books. Because if there are problems, some books cannot be obtained from the bookshop or from Amazon, you must speak to your seminar tutor and alert them to this problem. I think all the books are available. Okay, happy? Are you excited? Okay, see you next week. Bye. Oh, thank you.